Thank you for tuning in to the Essential Church Podcast, a church where we focus on restoration over denomination. If you're in the Virginia Beach area and would like to find out more about Essential Church, visit our webpage at essentialchurch.com.
This has been one of the hardest series to plan out simply because there are so many passages about fear in the Bible. How do you even begin to narrow down which ones you're going to discuss or talk about to bring out the essence and core of everything that God has taught about fear? There are so many stories about people who had to face their fears or overcome fears or deal with fears. How do you possibly choose which one of those stories you're going to put in there? And so I would be willing to bet if you have Bible verses you love about fear, anxiety, worry, there's a great chance I'm not even going to cover them or even touch them in this series. I think we'll do a Facebook post this week asking you what some of your best ones are. But the reality is, you know, why is it so pervasive throughout the scriptures? It's because it's such a big issue in all of our lives. A lot of us think we're the only one who struggles with fear. We have this idea that there's people out there who are kind of like a superhero mentality or maybe some sort of semi-sociopath that doesn't really have the feeling or emotion of fear, and they can walk through life with great courage and overcome all of those things, but I'm over here, I'm a scaredy cat. The reality is that fear is universal. Everybody struggles, everybody deals with it. That's why a scene like that in the movie Braveheart is such a classic. Because there he's talking about the very core essence of fear. And he taps into one of the biblical guidelines for how to deal with and overcome fear. And anytime you have anything that sort of touches into something that is from God, of course, it's going to strike a spiritual chord with all of humanity, whether they recognize or acknowledge the presence of God or not. It's still, he's the one who created us, and so it brings that out. And basically what he says in there is, as he's trying to lead all these Scotsmen to go up against the mighty England. And you watch that scene, and you get so inspired, you want to fight for Scotland, even if you've never been to Scotland. You want to root against England, whether you're watching them in the World Cup or anything else, simply because of that scene right there. As a matter of fact, it's such a memorable scene. Anytime my kids come home with any kind of problem in their English class, they're like, "Oh, Dad, can you help?" I'm like, "I don't know, the English are too many." And they always look at me like, "What are you talking?" I was like, "I can't help it." It just always comes out. They don't know the context, so hopefully now they've seen it and they'll know where I'm coming with that. But what he basically says is, yeah, there's a real fear out there, and I'm not going to tell you that there's nothing to fear. I'm not going to tell you that we're bigger and stronger and faster than they are. I'm not going to tell you that we have better weaponry than they are. I'm not going to tell you we have better strategy than they've got. I'm not going to tell you any of those things. The reality is there is something to fear up there, and the very real possibility that many of you are going to die today. That's a reality here. So it's not a question of overcoming fears by simply not having fears or taking away any threat that could be there. Rather, he says what? Is there something worth giving your life for? Is there something more important than your fear in this moment? And he simply says, is the possibility of freedom and gaining freedom for you and all of your relatives and everybody who comes after you, for your country and for everybody in your land, is that worth overcoming your fear today? And that's simply the question. And it's striking a chord that one author wrote, is that courage is not the absence of fear, but rather the value judgment or decision that there is something out there of greater value than my fear. There's something worth overcoming my fear for. There's something worth more important than the fear in this moment. It's why somebody would run into a burning building to save a child. They don't look at it and say, "Oh, that's not a big deal. I breathe fire for breakfast." Some of you may do that on the back porch. I don't know. But they don't really, it's not that there's something scary about the fire. It's just that they're more afraid of losing their child. Or typically where this happens is somebody will rush into a burning building to bring out a dog. And somebody who doesn't have the same value system will look at that and go, "You risked your life for a dog? Who would do that?" Well, clearly you're not a dog person. Now, I'm not even going to touch the thing about cats because I don't understand any of that. Besides, the cat probably wouldn't even be smart enough to come to you anyway in that moment, but I'm not going to go there with cats. That's your own value judgment. The point is at some point somebody made a value decision that what is in there is of greater value than my fear in this moment. And William Wallace is, of course, asking them, is this of greater value than your fear in this moment? It's the same thing you see in the book of Hebrews. The book of Hebrews is written to the Christian church at a time where they're under heavy persecution. If you were to come out and say that you believe that Jesus Christ is Lord, they took that as an affront to Caesar, who they believed is the ultimate Lord. And so they would say, oh, this is a treasonous statement, and they could haul you off, have you arrested, or even have you killed. They could have your whole family arrested for that. And so there's a lot of people who are questioning and second-guessing, am I going to stand for my faith and go public with who I believe in and what I believe, or do I need to cower in this moment? And so he's writing this letter to give them an encouragement to stand and to stand firm in their faith. And he says, look at all those who've gone before you. And so many people have read Hebrews chapter 11, which talks about, think about the kind of faith that Abraham had and that Moses had. These are the kind of faith that, you know, shut the mouths of lions and people overcome amazing odds simply because they stood firm and stood fast for God. And he builds kind of all this up, and you kind of turn the page from chapter 11 to chapter 12, and he kind of brings it all to this crescendo. In Hebrews chapter 12, he says, fixing our eyes on Jesus, who is the pioneer and the perfecter of our faith. And here's what it says about Jesus. It says, for the joy that was set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and thus sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. In there, he doesn't say the cross was no big deal. It wasn't, you know, any kind of thing. Jesus didn't have any fear in that moment. If you go back and read in the scriptures, Jesus is sweating drops of blood. And I think I mentioned in one of the past messages that I don't think it was so much the agony of the cross that was terrifying for him, although that is a real fear, it can be terror-inducing. It was the fact that on the cross he'd be separated from the Father, a fellowship that he had known for all eternity he'd be split apart from and separated from, and that was so fear-inducing to be alone. I was reading the list of top 10 fears. Number one on the list was to be alone. I thought it'd be death or public speaking, but actually it was alone, and then death, and then public speaking. If I ever am up here by myself and die, I will have conquered all three in one day. But it says that for the joy that was set before him, it's this picture that Jesus had in his mind, this moment, this day, when you would have the opportunity set before you to have all of your sins completely washed away and given exchange for his perfect life. It's a similar idea of perhaps maybe you've got in your mind you want to save up for something you want to give somebody, and so you work the extra overtime and you do all this extra hard work. And why are you making all that sacrifice for the joy set before you? For you're looking forward to that day when they're going to have this big smile on their face when they get what it is that you're preparing to give them. And so Jesus has this idea, and he's basically saying he looked at you and your life as of greater worth and of greater value than his own in that moment. He says, for the joy that was set before me. Overcoming fear is a value decision. It's saying there is something worth dying for. There's something worth giving my life for. And for the joy that is set before me, for the opportunity to give you the chance to spend an eternity with God in heaven, I will give you everything I've earned and everything I've deserved in my life, and I will willingly lay my life down for you. And so it says, for the joy that was set before him, that's why he endured the cross and the scorn of its shame. So fear is ultimately a value judgment. Now, I could go to any number of stories in the Bible to look at a story of conquering fear. I'm going to hit on several of them. I'm going to begin with the story of David and Goliath, one of the all-time classics. And I want to hit it because both David and Goliath try to overcome the fear of a battle in very different ways. Now, to think that there was no fear on either side is ridiculous. Anybody who's ever gone into battle is going to have some sense of fear, or at least should. Maybe part of the problem with Goliath is the way he dealt with his fear was by denying his fear. And so I'm going to read just highlighted portions. It's just too much here. I could teach a whole series on just David and Goliath. So I'm just going to be hitting some of the highlights out of 1 Samuel 17. This was the mindset for Goliath. I'm going to read the passages that deal with the mindset that Goliath had about approaching the battle. It says, he was a champion named Goliath. In other words, he had a track record of success going into this. Who was from Gath, who came out of the Philistine camp. His height was about 9 feet tall. He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he wore a coat of armor and a bronze weighing 5,000 shekels. On his leg, he wore bronze guards. He had a bronze javelin that was slung on his back. He had a spear shaft that was like a weaver's rod, and an iron point on it weighed 600 shekels. His shield bearer went out ahead of him. Goliath stood and shouted the ranks of Israel, why don't you come out and line up for battle? What, am I not a Philistine, your sworn enemy? Choose a man and have him come out and come down to me. If he is able to fight and kill me, we'll become your subjects. You can almost hear him laughing as he says it. If he's able. But if I overcome and kill him, you'll be my subjects and you will serve us. The Philistine said, this day I defy the armies of Israel. Give me a man, let us fight each other. And on hearing his words, Saul and all of the Israelites were dismayed and they were terrified. Meanwhile, the Philistine, this is when he actually goes out into battle with David. Meanwhile, the Philistine with his shield bare in front of him kept coming closer to David. He looks over at David and he sees he's little more than a boy with glowing health and he's quite handsome. In other words, he's a cute little guy. And he says, what, am I a dog that you're going to come out here with me with sticks? The Philistine cursed David by his gods. He says, come over here. I'm going to give you a spanking and teach you a lesson. He actually says, I'm going to feed your flesh to the birds of the air and the wild animals. But it's pretty much what he's saying. He's like, come here, little boy. I'm going to put you over my knee and give you a spanking out here on the battlefield. So what is Goliath's method for overcoming fear of the battle? It's your classic power of positive mental attitude. It's just, you know, think good thoughts, you know, remind yourself of who you are, tell yourself about your past victories, kind of go over it in your mind, you know, build up your self-esteem, just tell yourself, you know, I can't lose, everything's in my favor, think about all your strategy, everything you have building up. It's all the classic things that the football coach says to his team before they go out there to play the game. It's all this positive mental attitude stuff. And we have a way in the church of Christianizing everything you see in secular ideas. And so we'll Christianize it with these ideas of, well, oh, of course. I mean, if anybody has a reason for a positive mental attitude, it should be a Christian. You know, after all, you know, if you're doing the right thing and you're following after God and you've confessed your sin and you've got God on your side, you can't possibly lose. So go out there and fight the battle. And that's all well and good unless you've actually read the Bible and read some of the stories. Because if you like, go back to that passage in the Hebrews 11, it gives you all these great success stories. I mean, you know, Abraham and everything he did, he left his country and he came down and God blessed him and things worked out. And Moses, you know, he left, you know, out of Pharaoh's family and he goes out in the wilderness. He comes back as a conquering hero and leads them out. And then Joshua leads them into the land and Samson overcomes and God shuts the mouths of lions. If you read, kind of read on, it says, but there were some others who didn't quite turn out so good for them. They were sawed in half and burned at the stake. And you're like, whoa, it was sawed in half? Excuse me? Come again with that piece there? You said that really quick. What was that? Or Jesus himself, he turns to his disciples before he leaves. He says in John chapter 16, he says, listen, I've told you these things so that you might have peace. If there's a context for peace, there must be something that's going to disrupt my peace. He says, in this world, there's a possibility you might have some trouble. Just a small chance. Or if you know the passage, that's not what he says at all. He says, in this world, definitively, he says, you will have trouble. But take heart, I've overcome the world. Now, the next passage I'm going to read, I hadn't ever noticed it or studied it or even come across it until going through and reading all these stories about fear. It's one that will disturb your theology, if you will. Especially if you have this positive mental attitude that says, if I'm walking with God, he's going to clear before me. It says this, like, because I often have this idea that God's kind of like the icebreaker, and I'm like the little ship following the icebreaker, and he's going to go before me and fight my battles. Like, I love the story of Joshua and the city of Jericho. Like, we sing the song, Joshua fought the battle of Jericho, Jericho, right? Joshua didn't fight that battle. He just walked around the city, and God did all the work. I love when God does that. And sometimes I have this idea that every battle that we fight is going to be fought like that. That God's going to go before us, he's going to clear the way, and we just walk in and pick up the spoils of victory. And then you read a passage like this that's quite disturbing. Judges chapter 3. The setting for this is Moses leads them out of Egypt, and they fight a few battles under Moses' leadership until they get to the promised land. Then Joshua leads them into the promised land, and God kind of gives them the freebie there at Jericho, but then they actually have to go and fight some battles with their actual weapons throughout the rest of the book of Joshua. And they fight a lot of battles. They conquer all the major fortified cities. So then right after the book of Joshua is the book of Judges. And so you have the following generations that rise up, the grandkids of those who came into the land. And he says this, these are the nations that the Lord left to test all of those Israelites who had not experienced any of those wars in Canaan led by Joshua and Moses. God did this only to teach warfare to the descendants of the Israelites who had no previous battle experience. These nations were left to test the Israelites to see whether they would obey the Lord's commands, which he had given their ancestors through Moses. So let me break that down if you didn't pick up on it. God intentionally left obstacles in their path. God intentionally placed battles in front of them. This kind of messes up my theology of God being the icebreaker who clears everything out of the way. Rather, God's not the icebreaker. He's almost like the guy in Mario Kart. He's, you know, chunking stuff out the back, you know, purposely to see what's going to happen. And sometimes you read that and you're like, I don't need a God like that. I don't need a God who's purposely putting stuff out here. Sometimes I feel like he is. Now you're telling me he really is. So you mean to tell me that this battle that I'm facing, this obstacle that's in front of me, this thing that, you know, is fear-inducing, very well could be placed there by God to test me? I'm not telling you that. The Bible's telling you that. Flat out, that's exactly what God says. He says the problem with this generation is they hadn't fought any battles yet. They need to go through the battle. They need to get battle tested. They need to get battle hardened. They need to know what it's like to overcome their fears and trust and rely on me in the midst of it. It kind of shakes everything you think about when you think about God. Or what about what Jesus says when he sends out the disciples for the first time? So he sends them out while he's still around just so they can experience what life is going to be like after he's gone. Matthew chapter 10, verse 16. I'm sending you out like sheep among wolves. What football coach is going to say that? All right, guys. They call us the Rams, but really we're a bunch of sheep, all right? We're going to head out there. Those guys are bigger, stronger, faster, and you're probably going to get crushed. That's his pep talk, right? And if you don't think that's his pep talk, let me read on. Therefore, be as shrewd as snakes and as innocent as doves. I'll get into that later, or some other message, some other series. He says, be on your guard. Listen to the definitive predictions he's making for what's going to happen. You will be handed over to local councils and be flogged in the synagogues. Come again? See, before I get any further, I'm going to pause with a problem I have with this. See, this has been an issue that's been a struggle between me and God for a long time. You see, I look out there at the stuff that you all do for a living. Not that I'm looking down on it, but I just have a theological conundrum with God about it. Okay, so some of you are in the business of writing software, and so you're building a better software program to help somebody, you know, analyze data better. Some of you are building war machines over at the shipyards, and so you're trying to get these things turned around in a faster state. Some of you are contractors who are trying to improve efficiency or whatnot, right? And sometimes you might feel as though God's not really helping you get this accomplished, and it seems like everything that could go wrong goes wrong, right? You live in the world of Murphy's Law, right? That happened? And you see, I look at that and I say, well, you know, that's part of the curse that God says, you know, by the sweat of our brow we'll work from the land. It's going to be hard. There's going to be difficulty. But God, I'm on your side here. I'm doing what you want done. I'm trying to accomplish your purposes here. I understand if you're not going to help him with the software, you're not going to help them build the submarine. I'm trying to build your church for you to do what you wanted to do. Could you help me out? You see? And he doesn't help me out any more than he's helping you out. And so I read this stuff. I'm like, well, I guess it could be worse. Jesus says, on my account, you will be brought before governors and kings and witness to them about and to the Gentiles. And when they arrest you, don't worry about what to say or how to say it. You know, Jesus, that's really not my first worry. I'm still worried about the flogging thing. He says, at that time, I'll give you what to say. It won't be you speaking, but the Spirit of God will be speaking through you. You'll be in a time where brother is going to betray brother all the way to the death. A father will betray his child. Children will rebel against their parents and have them put to death. There'll be all kinds of chaos going around you. And he says, and you'll be hated by everyone because of me. But the one who stands firm to the end will be saved. And when you are persecuted in one place, run off to another. That's the strategy? Really? Run? And I tell you the truth, you will not finish. Am I getting this straight here? You're sending me out like a sheep among wolves. I'm going to get arrested. I'm going to get flogged. Everybody's going to hate me, and I'm never going to accomplish and never going to finish the whole task? This is not a good pep speech, right? This is not what you would expect from God, especially if you're going to go into the power of positive attitude, right? He says, but don't be afraid of them. For there's nothing concealed that won't be disclosed. Nothing that's hidden will not be made known. Listen, God said, listen, the stuff they do to you, I'm keeping track of. They'll pay for what they're doing. It'll all come out. And listen, what I tell you in the dark, so I've told you guys a lot, I've taught you guys a bunch of stuff, you need to go preach in the daylight. What's whispered in your ear, you need to proclaim from the rooftops. Don't be shy about this. You need to have some boldness about this. He says, don't be afraid of those who can kill the body but can do nothing to the soul. Rather, be afraid of the one who has the power to destroy both soul and body in the fires of hell. See, there's a value statement. Fear is a value statement. You're making a decision. You know, sometimes it's about this is worth dying for. Other times you're looking at it saying, you know, there's something more to be afraid of than what I'm afraid of right now. You know, overcoming fear and the key to courage is not about the power of positive thinking. It's about a value decision. It's about a value judgment that says either this is worth it, or sometimes you're making the value judgment that says, you know, there's a greater cost than what I think the real cost is here. And so William Wallace is kind of throwing up both of them. He says, listen, is freedom not worth it? And isn't there a bigger cost of living your entire life under tyranny? Isn't that a bigger cost than whatever it might cost you right now? Then he goes on, he says, are not two sparrows sold for a penny? Yet not one of them will fall to the ground outside of your Father's care. But birds do die, right, Jesus? Yeah, but God's aware of it. He cares for them. And even the very hairs on your head are numbered. I always wondered what the context for that verse was. Have you? It's in the Bible. Actually, it is the Bible. He actually knows how many hairs you have. So for some of us, the old joke is it's easier for him to count than others. So don't be afraid. You're worth far more than sparrows. Comes back and says, listen, there are some things worth dying for. There are some things, you know, to have a greater fear than whatever they could do to you. And you got to know that God's aware of it all. He'll be with you through it all. And so for Goliath, his whole idea was this power of positive thinking, and he's just going to, you know, overcome it. He could visualize his success, and he was all very confident. But he was also out of touch with reality. He had no concept that he could possibly lose that day. And some scholars who have looked at this, you know, from a military perspective, they said, you know, the great mistake that he made was being overconfident. It's how the number one team loses to the worst team. Why? They go into it overconfident. We don't even have to try. We don't even have to work at this. We can put our second team in. It's not a big deal. And so the overconfidence oftentimes leads to the very downfall. David, rather, he looks at it and simply says, who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? Who does this guy think he is? Who does he think he's talking to here? He's coming up against God himself. And David says to Saul, let nobody lose heart on account of this Philistine. Your servant will go and fight him. David goes on to say, I've fought against a lion and a bear. God help me do that. This should be no different. So you might say, well, how is this any different? He's basically looking and saying, listen, this guy is coming up against God. This is between him and God, and it's worth fighting for. This guy is defying the Lord our God. And for us to sit here and cower, we're basically sitting, you know, admitting and agreeing with him that our God is powerless to do anything. I know my God can. And so he goes out and he picks up five stones. There's been a lot of discussion as to why did he pick up five stones? Somebody's like, oh, it's kind of a lack of faith there in that moment. I'd say he's realistic. He could have missed. I know some people say, well, Goliath had five brothers. I don't read anything about them other brothers coming down out of the hills. I think there's a very real chance that David picked up the five stones because he understood there's a chance I might miss. Think about some of the other passages of people who walk into these situations. Sometimes we think faith is this faith confidence that God's automatically going to give us success. But there's no promise or guarantee of success. I mean, think about Esther. Her uncle Mordecai comes to her and he says, Esther, the king's issued out a decree that's going to wipe your, you know, all of us out. You need to go to him and do something about it. She's like, I can't go. He hadn't called for me. And if I just walk in, if I just barge into his presence, he could have me put to death in the moment. He's like, yeah, you know, but eventually that's going to happen anyway. And so she looks, she says, all right, I'm going to do it. Pray for me. And what does she say? And if I perish, I perish. She decides some things are worth dying for. Some things are worth taking the risk. You know, it's worth taking the risk of saving my, you know, all of my people for the opportunity. Otherwise, what am I doing? I'm just living out the rest of my days like all the other Scotsmen there who want to run off the battlefield. I think about Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. If you don't know this story, they're three Hebrew boys who are captive in a foreign country. They're being forced to bow down to an idol, and they say, no, we only bow down to God. And so they say, King Nebuchadnezzar, we don't need to defend ourselves on this before you in this matter. If we're thrown into the blazing furnace, the God we serve is able to deliver us from it. Did you catch what they said there? Does that rock your theology at all? God is able. You see, we want to say God will, right? We want to say God will. If I go through this, just tell me, God, you're going to deliver me from this, and I'll do it, right? Isn't that what we often say? You tell me you're going to give me success, I'll do anything. You tell me it's going to work, I'll do it, right? Aren't most of us that way? If you tell me that you could possibly, but you could not do it, let me know when you're certain, right? So it says, our God is able. And it says, and he will deliver us, your majesty. Oh, see, there's, that's the confidence I'm looking for right there. But did you get that? First, they acknowledge the reality that they have no guarantee from God, yet they have a faith in God that God's going to do it. They're not certain about it. They don't have a certainty, but if you have a certainty, you wouldn't need faith. Because the opposite of faith is certainty, by the way. So if you are certain about something, you don't need faith. That's like, I've taught my kids pretty well. If I'm betting you on something, there's no doubt in my mind I'm right. The only time I'm willing to wager anything is when I know 100% I am right. I'm not going to wager on any uncertainty, not even a 1% uncertainty. So anytime we're having an argument, I'll say, I'll bet you on it. They're like, ooh. Yeah. Mm-mm. So they're not at that point. They're saying God can do this, and we're confident he will. But read the next verse. And even if he doesn't, some of you are like, wait a minute, what happened to their great faith? It's a realistic faith. It's an honest faith. It's very similar to the Stockdale principle that says, you know, we have every confidence. He was a prisoner of war in Vietnam. We have every confidence that we'll be rescued. However, we live in the reality that it may not happen anytime soon. It may not even happen in our lifetime. And so it's both faith and realism all tied into one. He says, listen, God's able. We have faith that he will. But even if he doesn't, we want you to know, King, we ain't going to serve your stinking gods or bow down to this dumb thing. That's a paraphrase. You can read it. That's basically what they say. We want you to know, even if he doesn't. It basically says, you know, if God doesn't save us, that's okay. We're absolutely certain why we're alive. We're absolutely certain what we're living for. We're absolutely certain what matters the most. And we would rather walk with God as long as we live than to live outside of a relationship with him. We're all going to die at some point. It's only a matter of time. And I would rather die fighting for the right thing than to live for the wrong things and die anyway. So even if he doesn't deliver us, that's okay. And just think of it. I have this, sometimes I have these kind of odd thoughts. Like, what if, like, as you walk into eternity, it's like you're still wearing the clothes you wore, and you're not really sure where you are until you get there, kind of thing. And you're coming. What better way to walk into eternity than being extra crispy because you went into the furnace for God, right? I mean, seriously, like what an awesome moment that is, like to walk in, and like the next guy comes in after you, is like, did I land it? No, dude, you didn't land it. You're in heaven now, right? There's like, the skateboarder right behind you who goes off the thing, does, the triple backflip. Did I stick the landing? No. And yet you walk in, and I think most people, when they get put in a furnace, I think most people die. I think that's generally what happens. Can we agree on that one? I think most of the time, the lions get a tasty meal and are not disappointed in that moment. However, I did see one on Facebook recently where the lady did walk into the lion thing and didn't get eaten. I don't know. Not sure what that was all about. Over the course of the series, we're going to be looking at different aspects and different ways that God leads us and guides us to deal with our fears and our worry and anxiety. But for this morning, just one of the primary ones is you have to be absolutely certain what this life is all about. That's why I say it every single week. This life is about nothing more than a loving relationship with Jesus Christ that will last for all eternity. And if you lose sight of that, your fears will overcome you. You'll be paralyzed in a moment. You won't be able to walk into any situation to make a stand for what is right, to sacrifice your life for the joy that's set before you, because you'll have lost sight of what relationship really matters. You'll have lost sight that you're living in a game for all of eternity. in that passage in the book of Hebrews where it says, but there were others, it didn't quite work out so well for them. It says their hope was in a better resurrection. Their hope was an even better ending than what you think the best ending would be. You see, so often we think, you know, that the victorious ending is winning the way we want. We love the ending where they walk around in the fiery furnace and the king looks in there and he sees, you know, is that an epiphany? Is that Jesus there walking around? Well, I don't know what this is, but these people walk out. We love the endings where they shut the mouths of lions. We love those kind of endings, but the writer of Hebrews says, but, you know, there's a better ending than even that because all those people eventually died. The best ending of all is the one that ultimately ends with a resurrection with Jesus Christ for all eternity, because that's a death that never ends. And that's a glory and a satisfaction that you lived your life for what really mattered. Let's pray. Father, some in this room face very real fears as they actually go out into live combat situations and have practiced this over and over and over again, Lord, where they've walked into and faced their fears because of a greater love, a greater desire, of a greater value. Others of us, Father, are faced with situations where we're afraid to stand up for what is right. We're afraid to tell the truth. And so we live in this sense of fear because we've lost sight of what this life really is all about. Father, may we not have the kind of faith that will only follow you if the story ends the way we want. But rather trust that this life is so short and eternity is so long and so worth it, that we too might do and give and endure and persevere and walk into the battle simply for the joy that could be set before us, to see your face one day and hear the words, well done, my good and faithful servant. And in Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Thank you for listening to the Essential Church Podcast. Let me encourage you to pause for a moment and reflect on what you've heard. It's not the hearing of the word, but the application that makes all the difference.